Entrepreneurs in Space.
A private rocket full of cargo makes it into orbit.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm David Brancaccio in New York.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Tuesday, May 22nd.
Coming up, is borrowing more the solution for Europe?
Rebuilding Joplin, Missouri, a year after a devastating tornado.
Plus, hard feelings about pizza in Naples.
It's all just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The private company SpaceX today launched an unmanned rocket into orbit, carrying cargo for the International Space Station. If all goes well, docking with the station happens on Friday. SpaceX is owned by Elon Musk, the entrepreneur behind PayPal, the internet payment company. BBC science correspondent Jonathan Amos joins us from London. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning, David.
What do you make of this private sector effort to participate in space exploration?
Well, it's a very interesting new development, one has to say. I mean, if you look around the world governments at the moment, it's pretty clear to everybody that money is short. And so if you are going to go into space, which is a notoriously expensive business, then you're going to have to find more efficient ways to do it. And perhaps contracting out to the private sector is the way to go. We're going to find out in the next few days how successful SpaceX are, because this is a demonstration flight. But if it goes well, then a $1.6 billion contract will kick in, and they will take over cargo resupply to the space station for NASA.
Do you think there are enough entrepreneurial folk out there who want to get into this very risky business to sustain private sector efforts in space?
Well, I think NASA has had no shortage of companies wanting to come forward to do this. Some very new names like SpaceX, but some traditional names as well, like Boeing, are also trying to get into this private venture. I think one of the key things that we're going to see in the next few months, the next couple of years, is just how much money NASA has to play, the seed funding game, if you like, in order to bring these companies on. Because they have said, yes, we're prepared to put our own money into these ventures, but we do need a little bit of help from government, because some of these companies will not deliver in the end. And some politicians are unhappy about public funds being spent on things that will never materialize.
The BBC's Jonathan Amos in London. Thank you very much.
That's great, David.
The top nuclear official at the United Nations said today that a deal has been reached with Iran to allow the UN's investigation into Iran's nuclear program to continue. Tomorrow, Iranian officials will hold nuclear talks with the leaders of six world powers, including the United States. So what does all this mean for the price of oil, which spiked earlier this year because of tensions with Iran? For answers, let's bring in Julie Neiman, an oil and gas analyst with Smith Moore & Company. She's with us, as always, from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So, Julie, what do you make of this potential progress that a deal has been reached to allow the UN's investigation into Iran's program to continue?
Well, Iran has been playing the Korean game, a big game of chicken. You headed for a huge head-on collision. You swerve at the last minute. They were talking about if you go through the European sanctions, which start July 1st, you're going to go to $160 a barrel. So now they're making conciliatory noises, kind of a cool down.
And what does this mean for the global oil supply? How important is Iran in that regard?
Well, the world can't afford to lose uranium production. Saudi Arabia says, yes, we'll produce to full tilt if this goes through. European and USA will open up the strategic reserves, but those have limits. So it is important production, but you can't fight the markets at this point.
And Julie, what do you expect to happen this summer with oil prices?
Well, demand globally is stalled. Europe is in recession. We have about a 2% growth rate in the United States right now. There's flat oil demand, and China's slowing down. So basically, there really is not huge supply problem at this point. Gasoline, for those who can afford to drive, you're still going to see declining prices because we have plenty of inventory, except for production problems on the West Coast. The rest of the United States can be looking forward to a summer of lower gasoline prices.
Yeah, they really haven't lowered out here in California. Julie Neiman, an analyst at Smith Moore & Company. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Facebook stock plunged another 7% when Wall Street opened for business today. That after an 11% drop on Monday. Some look at the disappointing debut for Facebook shares and wonder if something's amiss generally in the technology sector. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Don't look now, but it's not just Facebook that investors have defriended. Zynga, maker of the video game Farmville, saw its stock dig 25% underground since it went public. And then there's Groupon. Northwestern University business professor Anoop Srivastava says there's a tech stock bubble that could be starting to deflate.
We haven't seen the whole cycle yet. Remember Groupon? Groupon lost 70% in first year of its trading.
He sees hysteria around Facebook and thinks the market has overvalued the company. Of course, the losers here are not the company founders. They cashed in when they went public. It's you and me, says Roger Kay at Endpoint Technologies.
All the public investors who came in and bought stock on the first day, last Friday, at 38, and it's now at 33, are basically in the red. So they're losing money, but that's Joe Public.
Still, even tech bears acknowledge time will tell if they're right. So watch Zynga, Facebook, Groupon, and Twitter, the so-called four horsemen of the internet. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Well, it's been 2 years since the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And today, officials from government and the industry will look at one item that was central to the spill, the blowout preventer. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
Blowout preventers are office building-sized machines that sit on the ocean floor, the last line of defense to keep crude from gushing out of a busted oil well. A new one costs up to $50 million. Sounds like a lot.
But small compared to the cost of cleaning up 5 million barrels of oil.
Roger McCarthy helped write the National Academy of Engineering report on blowout preventers. He presents findings to the industry today. McCarthy says offshore oil and gas drillers have self-regulated since the disaster.
I don't think the shortcuts, for lack of a better word, that were taken during the drilling of the Macondo well would be taken by any driller in the Gulf today.
But he says many oil wells still use the same blowout preventer that failed for BP. Only federal regulation can force an industry-wide switch to better technology. Not everyone thinks new blowout preventers are the key.
I think there's some in the industry who think, you know, that they work fine.
Tim Vandenberg at Washington Analytics says it depends on how you see the BP spill, as a human failure or a technical one. Some companies say better training can do just as much good and cost less than new technology. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
There's a new warning this morning from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD. It says the 17 nations that use the euro are at risk of falling into a severe recession. The OECD is calling on the European Central Bank, that's Europe's version of the Federal Reserve, to do more to stem the crisis. Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard is with us now from London with more. Good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
So what exactly could the European Central Bank do?
Well, what the bank's already done is pump more than $1 trillion into the European banking system in the form of low-interest three-year loans. Now, that held the debt crisis at bay over the winter, but the effect is now waning because of the political turmoil in Greece and the political change in France, the vote against austerity. That has stirred up the crisis again. Now, the European Central Bank could pump in more money, but a longer-term fix, which the OECD is pushing for, and the French favour, are Eurobonds.
Eurobonds. This is a term that's come up before.
That's right. I mean, this is where the 17 governments that use the euro raise money together. They borrow as one. They pool their creditworthiness, if you like. That means they could all raise money at the same relatively low interest rate. So Greece, Spain, Portugal would be able to borrow at a rate much closer to the German level. And one plan is that Eurobonds could raise money to pump into the Eurozone banks to stop them going bust.
But Stephen, this is not the most popular idea across Europe, right?
No. Well, certainly not in Germany. The Germans hate the idea because their borrowing costs would go up. They feel that countries like Greece would be leeching off their German creditworthiness. So they're also worried about moral hazard. I mean, they fear that if you allow countries like Greece to borrow more easily, we'll be back at square one.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thanks a lot.
Okay, Jeremy.
It's a day to take stock in the lessons from another disaster, this one in Joplin, Missouri. It's been exactly a year since the nation's deadliest tornado in 60 years killed 161 people there. Thousands of buildings were destroyed in the twister, including Joplin's only public high school.
We're joined now by the mayor pro tem of Joplin, Bill Scarce. Mr. Mayor, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Mr. Mayor, give us a sense of what the city looks like a year after the tornado. Can you still see the damage everywhere?
Well, you can see the results of the damage. Most of the debris has been cleaned up. Almost 100% of it has been cleaned up. But you can see the results of the damage where there used to be homes. There's just some vacant property still left. Very, very few businesses have not built back. Less than 40 businesses have indicated that they will not rebuild. But in light of that, we have 20 brand new businesses that have been constructed in the tornado zone, which gives us a net loss of only about 19 businesses, which we think is phenomenal.
Where has most of the financial assistance come from the state, from the federal government, from private organizations and charities?
Well, generally, it's been a mix of all, thank goodness. We've had great help from FEMA. We've had great help from the state of Missouri, which has done things for us. And then, of course, many, many of the faith-based operations and the volunteer groups, AmeriCorps, which coordinates all the volunteers. And I can't stress enough, without the volunteers who came to our community, and I would like to personally thank each and every one of them if they happen to be listening to you today. If they're not, I still want to thank them for the job that they have done for us, because they've given up of their time and their time with their in their lives and time with their family to come here and help us in this recovery effort.
How are you feeling this morning? It must be a pretty emotional day.
Well, it always is. Particularly when I realized that, you know, my daughter and her family were at what I consider to be ground zero, and they lost their home. They're fine, physically they're fine. They're still suffering a little bit emotionally from it, and they went through some counseling. But it is emotional for all of us.
Bill Scarce is the mayor pro tem of Joplin, Missouri. Mr. Mayor, thanks so much and best of luck.
Well, thank you. And tell the people out there we still need help.
We will do.
Thank you.
As soon as next week, Southwest Airlines could get clearance to build a brand new international terminal at Houston's Hobby Airport. But United Airlines, which has a huge hub at another Houston airport, is appealing to city officials to keep the plan grounded. From KUHF in Houston, Gail DeLauter reports.
If you want to get an international flight out of Houston, you have to drive about 20 miles to the north to what locals call the big airport, Bush Intercontinental. But discount carrier Southwest wants to start flying to Mexico and the Caribbean. And to do it, Southwest wants to build an international terminal at Hobby Airport. It's a smaller facility about 12 miles south of downtown. United Airlines has launched a huge protest against the move.
Every other example where we look at in the country where you have a split international gateway, that international gateway tends to stagnate or decline.
John Gibo is United's Senior Vice President of Financial Planning. The airline did a study that shows the local economy could lose about $300 million if international passengers are divided between the two airports.
Houston has built a very, very strong connecting hub complex at Intercontinental over the course of the last 40 years. And what that hub complex brings to the city is the ability for airlines, including United, to offer a larger number of flights and a larger number of direct destinations.
The Houston airport system also did a study. It predicts the local economy would gain about $1.6 billion. Southwest CEO Gary Kelly told a city council committee the airline doesn't want special treatment. It just wants to do business.
We're not asking for tax credits or abatements. We are, in essence, merely asking you to negotiate with us for an amendment to our use and lease agreement.
So why is United fighting so hard against the plan? It's a fear of competition from an airline that offers cheaper flights, according to Rice University business professor Doug Schuller. He says United is going to do all it can to try to persuade city officials to reject the new terminal.
They're going to say, we're legacy carriers. We're the ones who serve these mid-sized cities, and those budget carriers aren't going to go there.
Officials in the nation's fourth largest city are expected to make a decision on the new international terminal by the end of the month. In Houston, I'm Gail DeLauder for Marketplace.
Budget cutters in Washington are taking aim at the Census Bureau. Specifically, a spending plan passed by the House would put a stop to a yearly survey of 3 million households. The American Community Survey is a trove of data for government planners, and as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports, for businesses as well.
The American Community Survey reveals the median incomes for Latino households in Pima County, Arizona, jumped nearly $10,000 between 2009 and 2010.
They can crunch this data to know where growth is happening and how it's happening.
David French at the National Retail Federation says growth statistics can determine where new stores get built.
Without it, a lot of businesses, not just retailers, but home builders, would really be flying blind about where investment decisions in the next 5 or 10 years need to be made.
The survey can help manufacturers target their goods, says Maureen Haver of Haver Analytics.
Or also for other sorts of businesses to figure out what kind of workers at what educational level are in a particular area.
Budget cutters argue the survey is too expensive, but businesses are lobbying to save the data from the budget acts. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
After losing billions in bad bets on derivatives, JPMorgan Chase said yesterday it's going to keep some extra cash on hand to make sure it can keep its dividends flowing back to shareholders. The bank had been planning to buy back a pile of its own shares, but to save money now, it will halt the buyback temporarily. And you know who owns a little bit of that stock? Marketplace's regular contributor, Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large at Fortune magazine. He joins us here in the studio. What, Alan, you yourself are a JPMorgan Chase investor?
Well, by accident, having to do with having been a bank reporter 40 years ago in Detroit, I own 39 shares of J.P. Morgan, which is worth roughly
$1,300. $1,300. So a major investor in J.P. Morgan. So you get the annual report. You're an ace financial journalist. If you read that annual report carefully, maybe you could see this mess coming.
Well, maybe you could, except no human being can possibly read the annual report carefully. And do you know why?
Why?
It's 316 pages long, of which 250 pages are financial statements in type so small I have trouble reading it. And I'm sure it meets every legal requirement for disclosure. But it's not helpful. It doesn't tell you anything. Even if I parsed every blessed word in those 250 pages, there's no way I would have seen this coming.
So one of the problems here, of course, is that the big legislative regulatory response to the financial meltdown that followed Lehman Brothers was, let's bring more disclosure to the process. Let's know what's going on at these financial institutions. And you're telling me that even if there is disclosure, it's hard to really understand what's going on.
Well, it's hard for me as a civilian to understand what's going on. The regulators presumably have more disclosure and information than we do. But when you have a situation like Morgan, where it's clear the bank itself had no idea what was going on, or it wouldn't have lost whatever it's going to turn out to be, $3 billion, who knows? If the bank doesn't know, how are the regulators going to know? It's impossible.
All right. Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large, Fortune magazine. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Well, now to the UK, where the Environment Agency wants to get rid of the term drought. Officials say drought is too blunt of a word and often conjures up images of dry riverbeds and cracked soil, and not all droughts cause that kind of thing. One new term they're considering, David, environmental stress due to rainfall deficit.
ESRD. It sounds like a European bailout plan something like that. And finally, to a conflict between traditionalists and the avant-garde in Naples, Italy, Enzo Coccia has introduced what he calls ultra pizzas with toppings like baccalà or salt cod to you non-Neapolitans. There's also one with truffle oil that costs like $32 a pie. Now, the thing is, his rivals see pizza as a simple thing, born as a food for the poor. The Neapolitan Association of Pizza Makers says it is not okay with this development, and the Guardian newspaper has one third-generation pizza guy saying, "I've seen cream being used. It doesn't get any worse than that," unquote. Now, Jeremy, what do you hate on pizza? I got to know.
I like most things on pizza, but I'm not a huge anchovy person.
Not the anchovies. And the Brits are always putting corn on pizza, which drives me up the wall. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio.
Where the pizza is much better than it is here in Los Angeles, where I'm Jeremy Hobson, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.